Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, the Stitcher Radio app for your smart device, CairoRadio.com, and the all-new Adore Network at Adore.fm. Let's get started with the episode. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 270 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden. And this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom indeed, folks. Boom indeed. We've got a great show planned for you this week. Very, very amazing life story by none other than Mr. Bob Forrest, who I had the pleasure of having into the backyard studio, and he sat right here at the table, and we just chatted it up for probably an hour and a half, something along those lines. And yeah, what a fascinating dude. We talk a lot about heroin addiction in this episode. A lot about things he did and is not necessarily proud of. We also talk about his new record that is out, his solo album called Survival Songs, which basically tells his life story. And we'll be featuring music from that album, which comes out October 9th, by the way, later on this week. And it is it's very, very good. So we'll be featuring some key tracks from that album throughout the episode, and I hope you guys stick with us for the whole thing, because it is fascinating, man. Fascinating story of Mr. Bob Forrest. You may not recognize that name, or if you do, are you into reality television? Because if you are, you may recognize Bob's name. He was, basically Dr. Drew's number one man on Celebrity Rehab. He was one of the celebrity counselors on that show for many years. And Bob used to be in a band called Thelonious Monster, and also The Bicycle Thief, which came many years afterwards. But Thelonious Monster was a band in L.A. Had high hopes, man. And they were going to do big things. And then heroin basically dashed all of that, ruined it all, man. And it's an amazing story. And I urge you guys, there's also a documentary out about Bob right now. It's called Bob and the Monster. And I would urge you guys to go and check that out. You can stream it from Google Play or Amazon or iTunes, rent it there or buy it. And it's really a fascinating tale, and includes clips from this very, very notorious performance in 1993 at Holland's Pink Pop Festival, where Bob just goes ape shit. And just loses it. And that was kind of the downfall, man, the downfall of this genius musician, which many, many people in the rock and roll scene, especially in L.A., cite Bob as definitely an influence and a very close friend, and somebody who has not only been through all of the drug addiction, but is now helping people get out of it as well. Amazing story, man. I mean, the guy, you know, went from being an addict, going in and out of rehab, like what, 24 times or something like that in his life, until he finally kicked it, finally got clean, and then became a counselor and is now helping people, mostly in the music industry, get off this shit, man, and get their lives together. And his life mission now is just helping others. And And it's great. It's great. So we have a very, very good and candid conversation coming your way. Let's see. How is everything, everyone? I hope you all are well. Thank you for tuning back in this week. We'd like to remind you guys that our archives are still up at the website at air-raid.net. You can go there and listen to all 270 episodes now of the Air Raid podcast with conversations with Chris Walla, formerly of Death Cab for Cutie. Let's see, Mike McCready of Pearl Jam, Bob Saget, Jim Brewer, Aisha Tyler, Mike Birbiglia, Pete Holmes, Ron Funchess, all sorts of great people. Jamie Kennedy, man, people really loved that episode. And also bands like Sebado and Duff McKagan from the original founding member of Guns N' Roses. All sorts of people right there, man. Presidents of the United States of America. Let's see, Macklemore. God dang it, man. Blackalicious, Jurassic 5, Raz Simone. Man, the list goes on and on, folks. So go to air-raid.net, click on the Archives tab, and you can listen to, you can stream all of those episodes right there. You can also stream us from the new Adore Network at adore.fm. So go and check that out as well. Okay. Let's see. Big things. One thing on the docket. I've been thinking about this for a little while now. I've been thinking about changing the name of the show. And it makes me very nervous to do something like that because I know for a fact that there are a lot of people that do not tune in every week. They tune in when they see someone interesting coming up and they want to check it out. Or they just, you know, forget about it for a couple weeks and then come back and do that whole thing. So it scares me to change the name of this show to something else. And, you know, for fear of like people just dropping it in their feeds because they don't know what it is or they haven't heard that we changed the name or anything like that. So, yeah, I don't know, oh, man. I don't know. But I want to grow the show up. I'm tired of Air Raid. Air Raid has nothing to do with what this show is. You guys understand that, right? This whole show started because it was going to be me, Aaron, and my wife, Maraid, Air Raid, get it? Talking to our friends about other things, right? But it's totally morphed. Maraid didn't want to do it, but we had the website built already. So, duh, what do you do? What do? You keep the name because I do not know how to build a website. So we kept the name, and it's been going on for what? What are we in our fifth year, sixth year, going into our sixth year of being in production? And the name just does not fit anymore. So what I want from you guys who are listening to this, if you have a name or an idea that we can use, I'd love you to email me and tell me about it. Tell me your idea. Man, sorry, we just ate pizza and I am full to the brim here, folks. Yeah, email me, aaron at air-raid.net, and let me know your ideas for a new name of the show, and maybe we'll consider that. And let's see, the one that we pick, we will send all of the former Air Raid merchandise to you, if you want it. I don't want that to be a disincentive to sending us your ideas for a new name for the show. That would be terrible. You know what? I really don't want those t-shirts. I'm not going to send this A-plus idea into Aaron. No, we want you to send in the ideas, man. Send it to us, aaron at air-raid.net, if you've got a good idea for a new name for the show. And then we'll start thinking about that and rebuilding the website and doing all that stuff. But, yeah, that's probably a long time off. Probably a long time off. All right. But we'd love to hear your ideas, folks, okay? All right. Let's do this. Let's go with our first music break. Oh, did we? Okay. Did I mention Bob's got a book out, too? Bob's got a book. You got to go to bobforestmusic.com. Check out Bob's website. They've got a bunch of events coming up as well. They just did a reading here in Seattle on Saturday. And then he came over here in the morning on Sunday, and we chatted it up. He's going to be in Washington, D.C. on October 10th at the Potter's House. Let's see, October 12th in Minneapolis, Minnesota at Bone Shaker Books. San Diego, California on the 14th of October at the Whistle Stop. Los Angeles, California at Book Soup on the 15th. San Francisco on the 16th at Adobe Books. Big Sur, California, Henry Miller Library on the 17th, 18th in Reno, Nevada, at Sundance Books and Music. Let's see. And the list goes on. So go to bobforestmusic.com, check out the events page, and go see him live, man. He's doing readings from his book. What's the book called? Here, we got it right here. Running with Monsters. Which is out now. You can get it where books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Google, iBookstore, IndieBound. There you go. Okay, it's available there. And he's going to be playing music and reading from his book, which by all accounts I have not read, but it sounds very, very good. I want to get my hands on that as well. And then, of course, the documentary film, Bob and the Monster. Cannot recommend it highly enough. Sundance winner, okay? Well, I don't know what it won, but it won something at Sundance, all right? So do that. Go and watch that. All right. Okay. Oh, my God. All right. This is the title song from Bob's new album, out October 9th, off of the album Survival Songs. This one's called See That My Grave Is Kept Clean. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest today, Bob Forrest. All right, stay with us.
Well, there's one kind favor I'll ask of you now. There's one kind favor I ask of you now. There's this one kind favor I'll ask of you right now. You see that my grave's kept clean. Well, there's two white horses keep following me wherever I go. There's two white horses keep following me wherever I go now. There's two white horses keep following me wherever I go now. They're waiting on the dying ground, waiting for me. Hey, did you ever hear some coughing sound, low, low? Did you ever hear some coughing sound, low, low? Did you ever hear a coughing sound, low? It means another poor boy's underground. You're dead and gone. Did you ever hear some church bell tolling for your friend? Did you ever hear some church bell tolling for your friend? Did you ever hear some church bells were ringing, tolling low? That means another friend is dead again. Yeah, dead and gone, low, low. One day my heart's gonna stop beating and my hands are gonna turn cold, Lord. One day my heart's gonna stop beating and my hands are gonna turn cold. One day my heart's gonna stop beating, and my hands are gonna turn cold, and I'll be going, yeah. And still I won't believe what the Bible told, no, nah, no. There's this one kind favor I ask of you right now. There's this one kind favor I ask of my friends now, now. There's this one kind favor I'll ask my friends, oh, oh. You see that my grave's kept clean. Yes, see it clean. Yes, see it clean. That means remember me well, cause I was alright. That means remember me well, cause I was alright. That means remember me well. Remember me well. Remember me well, cause I was alright.
You have Skype, right? And I was like, I think so. And they're like, well, you can just you can just say it over Skype. And I was like, shouldn't I be there, like watching the film?
What was this for?
It's this TV show I'm working on.
Yeah,
it's about drug addiction and stuff like that. You know, I'm kind of the drug.
You're kind of that guy now, right?
Commentator. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So I heard the story last night that you told on, I believe it was like Loveline or something, of the first time you ever stage dove.
Yeah. On the blind guy?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was so horrible and trauma. It was traumatizing.
How old were you at that time?
Well, that was probably like in 85, so 24, 25.
And was that like a Fishbone concert or something like
well,
that?
Well, yeah, it was Fishbone, Jane's Addiction, and Thelonious Monster, and we were playing because Norwood's, the bass player of Fishbone's ex-girlfriend, had run away with his son.
Oh, wow.
And so we were trying to raise funds for him to get a private investigator. And finally it all worked out. And
yeah, yeah.
Everything. But so, you know, it was like right when L.A. rock was kind of rising up. And so, Flea and I and John Cusack, actually, was the third guy. And we were standing there, and they said, let's stage dive. And we were standing off, you know, by the side of the stage, by the monitor board.
Right.
And I'd never done it before, and Flea had done it a lot. So then we each got assigned one monitor to run up on, use as a diving board.
Yeah,
out
yeah.
into the crowd. Flea went first, and so then I went, and then John went, and we all just jumped off these monitors, and we're sailing through the air. And because we had a good running start,
yeah.
and we had a thing to jump off of.
Uh-huh.
And so I was up in the air, and I still remember it. And then I was going feet first, which I guess is against the rules, and people were spreading out. You could see it was just like in frozen motion.
You were basically doing a flying kick.
I know. I didn't know how to do it. I never did it again. But the guy that I was going to land on, everyone else was putting their hands up or spreading out, and the guy I was going to land on was just standing there.
Yeah.
And I remember just both my feet just hit right on his shoulders, and I could hear his head hit on the ground. I was like, I'm so sorry. I knew when I was, before I hit him, that this is a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it turned out he was blind. This is the story of my life a lot of times.
And that basically set you off for the next 10 years of your career, right?
But people around started like beating me up, and bouncers came over and me up, and it was crazy.
Oh, my God.
Because, I mean, everybody knew that's a dumb idea. I didn't know, I guess Flea jumped and then laid backwards with his butt first, kind of. But I'm not sophisticated at that stuff. I always
You're not a gymnast like
Flea. I always like Kiss and Led Zeppelin and Aerosmith. I liked punk rock, but I wasn't like having a mohawk and getting down in there.
How did John do? How did John Cusack do?
He landed okay? I never heard anything. I know he had, he's a had a big trench coat, I remember, so that might have worked like a parachute or something. But I think, you know, there's jumping. I didn't know how to do it, so I was just going for it, like how I had seen in those Ed Culver pictures. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I was like, wait, 10 feet past those guys where they landed. Because I think there's a protocol. You just turn and then kind of lay down on the crowd.
It sounds like you may have missed your calling. You could have been a very good basketball player.
Or jumper.
Yeah. Well, Bob Forrest joining me here in the backyard. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today, man.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a real real honor to meet you and have you sitting across this table from me.
You seem like a guy like me that just loves music their whole life. Just being in your house. I come in, Oasis is on. I love Oasis. And people like, I don't like when a band is very popular and great, and then they maybe do some not so great work, and people just marginalize them. I still listen to Oasis.
Well, I've been on this kick lately where I've been listening to a lot of British pop.
Blur, too?
No, not so much Blur, but The Laws. Yeah. I've really been getting back into The Laws. Have you listened much to that album?
I know them. They were around Hollywood hanging out. I know why they didn't make many more records.
Well, yeah, that story is just absolutely insane about Lee Mavers, you know, wherever that guy might be now. I have no idea. But yeah, I went down a rabbit hole just the other day of like rediscovering my album, The Laws.
Yeah.
And just like whatever happened to these guys and
great
just really
pop
just
music,
oh
man.
My God, man. Yeah, yeah. Amazing stuff. So you've always been kind of more into the straight ahead kind of rock and roll, not so much punk, but blues inspired.
Yeah, music. To me, punk rock is this evolution of things, and then the stuff that happened up here is this evolution. It all begins like a long time ago, and each generation gets inspired in new ways by the bands that were inspired by the prior. And I'm more interested in, like, where did it come from? Like, that's where I've always...
Where are the
roots? I was like 12, 13 years old, right?
Sure.
I mean, when I heard Pet Sounds and I read that, you know, it was the Four Freshmen, I went and got my dad's records and listened to the Four Freshmen. I've always just been like that, like a musical archaeologist.
Freshmen, I'm not familiar
with
that.
They were the thing that Brian Wilson liked, that four-part harmony type thing. And my dad had those records. And I've just always been like, you know, like an archaeologist of this stuff and trying to figure out. What's interesting to me is the things that become popular in pop culture are usually the less soulful of that kind of music.
I would agree with that. Yeah,
it's
totally.
It's so peculiar to me. Like, I'm sure I don't pay attention to pop music now, but I'm sure there's a real Taylor Swift out there somewhere. But she's the one that everybody's...
Sure.
You know, she's the mass audience person.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
She was
the one that got wrapped up.
Yeah.
Right?
I saw this Laura Marling on the Austin City Limits. She was so great. You know that girl?
No. Uh-uh.
She's, you know, it's like that country poppy kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just still go to record stores two or three times a week, and I just dig and love and, you know.
Yeah, that's great, man.
Yeah.
Amoeba. I love seeing that too.
You ever go to Amoeba down in LA?
No, I've never been to any record store in LA. Oh, and I've always wanted to go to
Amoeba. It's like a cathedral there.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if you hear like, oh, this Charlie Hayden record, I gotta get it. You go there, it'll be there.
It'll be there.
You know what I mean?
I'm more of the type of person that and this is gonna sound awful and make me look bad, but if I hear something I'll just go online. Like I don't like to leave my house.
Well, why would you? You've got a great
family.
It's a beautiful
place, right?
You got your work here. It's great.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Why do I even need to?
Yeah. I was down in the cool part of town last night. It seemed like there's a lot going on. Is the Crocodile Cafe still open?
Yeah. Yeah, they reopened. They refurbished everything and reopened.
The band and bands play there?
Bands. Yeah, yeah. I go down there. I did an interview with John Spencer down there, which went awful.
What happened?
Absolutely terrible. Well, I mean, you know this. You have your own podcast, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a guest-based forum?
Yeah, but I only ask my friends. I know what I'm going to get.
Yeah, yeah. So there are some people that I get very nervous Like, John Spencer is one of those guys that, like, you know, I probably should have taken, like, a beta blocker or something before because I was shaking. I was so nervous to talk with this guy. Because, you know, you build these people up in your mind.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not as steeped in the music industry as you are. So I haven't had the chance to meet a lot of these people. A lot of the times I'm meeting people for the first time and trying to have an in-depth conversation with them.
Yeah.
And they may have had that conversation before. And so John Spencer, I think, felt like he had had that conversation before that we were having.
Oh, fuck him. You know what I mean? Well, here's the thing that I see my friends do that, and I'm just like, dude, you know, buy the ticket, take the ride. Two of my friends that were very successful at music shy away and don't like, you know, being in the public eye or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You know, then don't make records. It comes as part of the whole deal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think it's flattering that people want to listen to your music or talk about your music. And I know that it, you know, they're not taking pictures of your kids and, like, being all horrible to you. They just want to know when you made that great record, like, where you made it and who the songs are about. Because I'm that way about people. And, you know, I always want to know who the songs are about. Are you like that or what the songs are about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally.
I always thought, you know, why doesn't somebody have a show just about what is, you know, these days about, like, ask them what that, you know, that song These Days by Nico.
Yeah,
it's always rumored that Jackson Browne wrote it. He didn't write it. Did you know that?
No, I never even heard that rumor.
He was her boyfriend at the time or something.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I just love the little kind of weirdness of music and how friends join together and how bands form and what songs are about, what inspires songs. I love the idea that Brian Wilson heard the Beatles' Rubber Soul and made Pet Sounds. He said, I'm going to make a record as good as that.
Yeah.
And he had that in the back of his mind as an inspiration. So the Beatles inspired Brian Wilson to make questionably the greatest record ever made.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Have you seen that documentary about the Wrecking Crew?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Isn't it so great?
Oh, my God.
How cool is Carole King?
Wow. Holy shit.
I got to get those sunglasses.
Like, yeah, no kidding, right? Yeah. No, I was watching that documentary. I was like, man, I got it. I got to go down this rabbit hole now.
Maybe you can answer a question that Keith Morris was on my podcast a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And I just watched a documentary that he was in. And Dave Grohl was in. And I...
Which one was it?
I forget what one. I watch them all. So,
yeah.
Because I got the documentary channel on Netflix.
Right, right. Like that, you know. Yeah.
So I asked Keith, like, who do you think's in more documentaries, you or Dave Grohl? And he said, me by far. Dave Grohl hasn't been around that long.
So let me ask you, since we're talking about documentaries, this documentary about your life, which came out a couple years ago, which is still being, you guys are still having that go around the festival circuit.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And now it's on
the film festival
iTunes or something.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Bob and the Monster. It's a great film. Very interesting. How did it feel having a camera crew follow you around and kind of poke and prod find out about the deepest, darkest things in your life?
Well, how she edited it, how she found all that footage is pretty amazing. But I guess people from... over a period of time that had film, they would contact her. She had some ability to get a hold of that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it was really emotional to watch it. And because it's not just about me, it's about LA in the 80s. It's about drug addiction. It's about, you know, what happened to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very powerful. And there's one moment that I really like, cause there were, you know, I'm not too much of a braggart the way I'm a bit of a narcissist. Thelonious Monster was good for about 2 years. It was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And being in something that's really good and you don't even know why it's good is a unsettling, magical feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I mentioned to her, like, you know, everybody talks about Thelonious Monster when I was, you know, shooting drugs on stage. That we were just like a joke then. I was just trying to be Darby Crash or something.
Yeah.
But we became really good. And then as soon as the record company stuff got involved, that kind of magical thing about it kind of evaporated. So I said there would be moments on stage where I would just turn to Dix and for a guitar solo and look at Pete and just know how fucking good we were.
Yeah.
And she found footage of it.
Yeah.
Of this moment. That moment, you know, left as soon. It's kind of like being stoned on pot. As soon as you realize you're that good, it goes away and you're not that good.
Right.
As soon as you know what the meaning of life is about, it goes away.
And then you're already, and then you're always chasing that dragon, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that, she captured that, and, you know, and it really is so interesting. What is magical about a band? Why is it so magical? I've seen so many bands be magical, you know, and you go see them 2 years later and they're not magical.
Right.
And so people like us that are huge fans, we want to talk to the guys that were magical about when they were magical.
Yeah.
But all they want to talk about is their new album that sucks. You know what I mean? Elvis Costello, the king of that. I went to Elvis Costello. Like, to me, I named my son Elvis after Elvis Costello. And
did you really?
Everybody always thinks it's Elvis Presley. And now he knows, and he'll go, they'll say, after Elvis Presley? And he says, no, after Elvis Costello. So, like, from
that's
when he,
great.
From My Aim Is True through to, God, almost, you know, to the late 80s, it's just everything he does is so magical.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of stuff he's done the last 20 years, not so magical. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of difficult because you're going to see him. I've seen him probably 40, 50 times. I wasn't a big fan of the Burt Bacharach record, so mm-hmm. I didn't go. It was one of the first Elvis Costello tours in 25 years I didn't see because I didn't like the record. I didn't want to go. I don't like Burt Bacharach. I don't, you know.
Sure. How do you not like Burt Bacharach? Come on.
I like Dionne Warwick. I don't necessarily like Burt Bacharach. He just looks too weird to me.
He does have kind of a like a Vincent Price thing.
He has like
going
a Playboy Mansion look to him, too, that really makes
sense.
Yeah,
maybe like a Vincent Price crossed with the present incarnation of, what's his name? The Playboy Mansion guy.
Hugh Hefner,
yeah.
Well, you see, I grew up in the 70s. Like, that was a lot of swinging was going on. I grew up in Palm Springs.
Yeah.
And we'd go,
did you ever
like,
go to a key party?
No, I watched. I've watched, like, all kinds of crazy stuff when I was, like, 12 or 13. Because we'd just, you know, look over fences at neighbors' yards and stuff would be going on. And a lot of the people that were doing that looked like Burt Bacharach. So maybe I was traumatized. Anyways, I don't go. He comes back through town like a year later with just Steve Naive and him playing acoustic set, which I had seen before and I loved. And so I bought like a pretty expensive ticket. And, you know, I'm thinking he's going to do The Wheel or he's going to do, you know, old songs or whatever. And he didn't have an album coming out. So I figured it's not going to be the Juliet Letters. So I bought a very expensive ticket like in the fourth row.
Yeah.
The fourth song off the Burt Bacharach record, he begins, I didn't really mean it to be heard, but I said, give us a fucking break. And it was silent, and he could hear it, and he stopped playing for a second. And he was looking down,
no.
And everybody pointed at me. And I was like, I'm so sorry. But really, give us a fucking break here.
I ran into him. I ran into him a couple years back at the Sasquatch Music Festival.
Doesn't he live around
Gorge.
Here? He lives around here, doesn't he?
Does
in
he?
Vancouver or something?
Oh, I didn't know that. But I ran in. I literally ran into him.
Physically?
I was holding a beer, and he spilled it all over my shirt and my pants. And he goes, "Oh, I'm so sorry."
Oh,
and
that's
I good. And I said, "Man, you just gave me a story for the rest of my life." Yeah. That's fine.
What did he say?
He just smiled. He winked and smiled and walked
cool.
off. Yeah. So that was my one run-in with Elvis Costello.
But my thing is, a lot of the people I admire the most are not very nice of people. I don't know why. Bob Dylan, Elvis Costello, they're known to be a little thorny.
Be prickly.
Yeah.
Fashante. Have they earned that, though?
Fashante. Yeah. They can be prickly.
Yeah. Yeah. They've kind of earned it, right?
But,
yeah. Yeah. They've gotten to that level.
Yeah, I don't know about Queens of the Stone Age to be too prickly, but come on.
Oh man,
I have a house in Joshua Tree, and I see the, you know, it's like,
oh, yeah,
people pilgrimage to there to try to find, you know, that Josh guy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right.
I might be into that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You ever been out there?
Nope.
You see the Dave Grohl recording documentary thing?
Yeah, the
recorded
yes.
at that place. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah.
This is my friend Fred's place. He passed away years ago. Now Dave Ketchings runs it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
yeah. I had some friends here from Seattle in a band called Hobosexual.
Oh, that's
recorded there as well.
I like that name.
Yeah, right. It's pretty good.
Do hobos have sex? I think
they course.
Do.
Of course,
of course, they must.
Yeah, there's a fetish out there for everything, man.
There's a fetish for everything. I'm from LA.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. So music started, your love affair with music started from picking up your dad's records.
Yeah. Well, listening to them, you know, my dad had a bunch of brothers, and they get drunk on Friday night and play Glenn Miller and Duke Ellington and big band stuff.
Sure.
And so, to me, always like fun and celebration was music. That was like when I'm 6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And then I had older sisters, and they were into like the Beatles and the Doors and stuff like that. And so I learned about music from them.
Yeah.
Then it was a strange thing. We lived in Palm Springs. Like, it's a long story. It's like my sister's my mother. It's
right.
too much to get into.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you've
yeah.
seen the movie Chinatown, it's kind of like that. So they kind of kept me out there to be away from the, you know, out of the Los Angeles community because they were, you know, pretty successful in business or something.
Uh-huh.
So we lived this kind of isolated world out there in Palm Springs, like, and I would just be in my room a lot just listening to records, either my sister's records, and then I started buying my own records and the radio, and just music was just so important. It was like the life's blood.
Mm-hmm.
If you live in this isolated community where there's no kids around, and you know, it wasn't like we were riding bikes, it was 120 degrees.
Yeah, yeah, right.
A bunch of retired people. So you stayed in your room a lot and you listened to records. And then my sister got Ziggy Stardust in like 74 or whatever,
yeah.
when I was 13, I was like, oh my fucking God, there's a whole nother world out there. You know, because the Beatles seem like, and the Rolling Stones and the Doors, it seemed like, you know, like that's a movie star world. But
right.
Ziggy Stardust was like, it was so raw and real and like this is like my life. Or it was the first record that really spoke to me, and then I became like a Bowie freak. And and it was weird in that era. So Bowie comes along, then there's Alice Cooper, then there's Kiss. So anything that wore makeup, I liked.
Right.
I just didn't really, because I didn't know the rules of music, like Americana, glam rock.
Well, you're still young at that time, man. It's like, you got to put something into a genre,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. And it was just this kind of, you know, so Kiss and that, then the mid-70s roll along and I'm just off to the races. My dad killed himself, and I was just kind of carefree, running around.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't put it in the movie because, like, my sisters say he didn't kill himself, so I don't want to argue with them.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He had become sick and had open-heart surgery, one of the first open-heart surgeries in California, and he became an invalid immediately. Nowadays, it's so the magic of medicine. Like, I work with this doctor, with Dr. Drew, and I had open-heart surgery, and like in like 8 days, he was back to work.
Right.
My dad went from being a vital, like, take-care-of-business guy to, like, an old invalid
yeah.
from heart surgery. And so it was very, like, you know, very primal and you know, in its beginning stages. So he couldn't walk very good, and he had to take all this medicine. He just fucking hated it. So then he just stopped taking his medicine and had a stroke and died.
Really?
Yeah. So to me, that's suicide.
That's a form of suicide,
sisters,
yeah.
It's like, oh, how could you say that about dad? I'm like, well, what do you call it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
well, suicide's a weird thing, man. Like, I you know, it's a very heavy subject, and I don't think, you know, a lot of people can accept the fact that somebody would do that even though they still loved you.
That,
you know
that's
what I'm saying?
A big part of it, yeah.
And that's a really hard thing to kind of grasp.
You're choosing not to be here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was a... I just shut down and just started smoking weed. And
how old were you at that
15.
Point? You were 15 years
so
old.
So I was, started smoking weed and going to concerts and you know, Peter Frampton and Day on the Green. You ever heard of these shows?
Oh, yeah.
There was festivals, Day on the Green and Anaheim Stadium, and we would just go. We would just drive. By that time, I lived in San Jose for some strange reason.
Uh-huh.
And we'd drive down to Anaheim Stadium to see Leonard Skinner. We'd go to Oakland Coliseum to see Fleetwood Mac or the Eagles. Like, me and my friends, we just smoked weed and went places to see bands.
Yeah,
and so then punk rock hit. By the time I settled down back down in L.A., I worked in a record store, and punk rock was hitting, like, in 77. And I remember the first punk rock record I bought, or I... You know, we were hearing about punk rock, but didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
And the Sex Pistols 12-inch of... I think it was Pretty Vacant, or I Want to Be Me. I Want to Be Me. And it was a 12-inch, and I'd never really seen a 12-inch. Like, why would you make a record that only has two songs on it? I remember thinking that.
Doesn't make sense.
I remember just looking at the cover thinking, this is another one of those moments like David Bowie, like, this is it.
Yeah.
Right? And then that, you know, inspired so many kids in Southern California, and then you get Black Flag and Weirdos and Germs and...
Uh-huh.
And then you get Green Day eventually.
Yeah, right, right. And then this point somehow. Of the conversation, somehow, Green Day happened.
Yeah.
Somewhere down the line, the evolution brought us to that point.
Well, it's funny because I do have a 28-year-old son also, and I watched him explore all that simultaneous to that Green Day, No Doubt world that was his generation's
right,
music.
Right. Were you one of those parental figures that was like, no, that's not, you can't listen to that.
Let's listen to this. But, you know, I didn't want to turn him off to the things I was trying to turn him on to.
Right.
And then, you know, he started liking the Germs. The Germs, it's either Germs, Black Flag, Circle Jerks.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always one of those.
Yeah.
And I remember he started playing guitar and he started playing Germ songs. And I was like, there you go. No more Green Day, no more.
We've got
it. I think he's still playing. He lives in Baltimore. He's still playing it.
Excellent, man. Yeah. Excellent. Well, let's do this. Let's go to our second musical break.
Okay.
We're featuring music off of your new album, Survival Songs, which was recorded outdoors in Big Sur, some of it was recorded outdoors.
It was recorded. Flea has this cabin that's adjacent to his house.
Uh-huh.
And so we set up in there, and we'd play in there, but then it's so quiet and so peaceful and so still. I just thought, well, can we set up outside? And I did it. And
does the fog reach up to where you guys were at?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that is just the coolest.
It's a crazy part of the world.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's go with our second musical break, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Bob Forrest. Be back in a moment.
Well, it's a Sammy Hagar weekend. It's a Sammy Hagar state of mind. It's a Sammy Hagar weekend. It's a Sammy Hagar state of mind. Gonna drink some beer, smoke some pot, snort some coke, and then drive. Drive on 55, cause it's a Sammy Hagar weekend. Yeah, it's a big man's day now, yeah. We got a Metallica t-shirt, got a little tiny baby mustache, got a jacked up a Camaro. We're sitting in the parking lot at Anaheim Stadium, just drinking beer, smoking pot, snorting coke, and then drive.
it's a Sammy Hagar weekend. On a Sammy Hagar weekend. We're all grown up now. Sammy Hagar weekend. Sammy Hagar weekend. Sammy Hagar.
So what year did we end there? It was like, what, the early 80s?
Yeah, when punk rock hit.
When punk rock was coming to L.A.?
Yeah.
Now, when did you get involved with actually playing music?
Well, I mean, I was really inspired by a lot of weird, the more, like, avant-garde punk rock. And like mm-hmm. I said, I was never a stage diver. You know what I mean?
Right.
I was kind of like, I guess, nerd or whatever. But I was into bands like DNA, this band that Airtel Lindsay had from New York, and the like that whole thing, that Thurston Moore world that inspired him. I was really into that living in LA, and Public Image was the band that really was not punk rock, but was everything about punk rock.
Okay.
And so I had a band that was kind of modeled after Public Image with Chris, the guitar player, Thelonious Monster, when we were in college. And you know, I played guitar, which I still don't know how to play guitar very well. You can imagine what I was like 35 years ago. We were just a noise band.
Sure,
fuck Reagan and abortion and you know, a lot of very much modeled after Public Image Limited.
Yeah.
And then that kind of dissolved. And I was in college. I was a philosophy major, believe mm-hmm. it or not. And Chris met Pete and John, the bass player and drummer that would eventually be Thelonious Monster. And we kind of, you know, formed with this idea of being a punk rock jazz band, like inspired by the Lounge Lizards and John Lurie and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But we weren't good enough musicians to really do that.
Couldn't really pull that off.
So it became more like this thing. And I went and saw, I know we had rehearsed a few times, and I went and saw this band that Exene from Exit told me to go see called The Replacements.
Yeah.
And they were on the Hootenanny tour. And I remember I saw them and I was like, fuck, this is like singer-songwriter music, like, but it's so badly played. Maybe we could do that.
And it seems to work.
It worked. Oh my God. And Bob was really the only guy that could play.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, we just need a really good guitar player, and then we can write songs, and, you know, and that's what Thelonious Monster really was. Very much. We wanted so much to express ourselves, and then we stumbled on this band that was writing real songs. Like, if only you, I remember that night they did If Only You Were Lonely.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard that song?
No.
It's a B-side of a single. It's one of the greatest, like, folky rock songs. And I just thought, well, we can do that. We can write real songs. Because I was really disillusioned by punk rock right off the bat. Like, unless the Germs, G.I., and some of the original records made. But after that, by the time it gets to 82, 83, it's kind of been the same ever since.
Right,
you know,
the
L.A. punk sound, Bad Religion.
Sure.
Not anything against that, but just it never really inspired me, that kind of sound.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Replacements did. Oh,
well, they
God.
Had, a, they had, yeah, they did definitely had more of, like, for lack of a better term, like a classically trained background. You know, you know what I'm saying?
They liked Kiss and Aerosmith and Led Zeppelin, too.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, when I say classically trained, that's what I'm talking about. I'm only 35, okay?
I know, you're young.
That's classic music for me.
But and that's obvious in that Shit Hits the Fans record they made.
Right.
Like all the covers they do, like Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy.
Yeah,
come
totally.
On now.
Yeah, man.
I grew up on that music. A lot of bands up here grew up on that music.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, for sure. The Replacements just came and played a show. I think it was at the Paramount here in town just a couple months ago.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. I think it was sold out, too.
Yeah, I saw him at Coachella. It was weird, and Paul was not, he was kind of depressed.
Oh, really?
He doesn't want to be nostalgia, which, you know, music is nostalgia. It's not that bad.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I don't understand what's wrong
with that. I've never gotten that.
So, you know, if you're an artist, you want to keep writing songs and whatever, but you know, I got into a system there in the early 90s where you just write songs because you have a record that's going to be due and you just become a machine. You know what I mean?
Sure.
This is, all of a sudden, you make records, be inspired, and you're trying to express yourself and trying to get somebody to put it out. Then, if you're lucky enough, like so many of us were, to get into the system where people can have access to your music, all of a sudden it's very mechanical.
Right.
You know,
right.
I just...
Well, it becomes a machine. It becomes a business.
Yeah, you have to write songs so that, because you gotta, like, you're going to have to make another record, and you know what I mean? And so there's that strange kind of expectation that's put into it that's it's not real. So I just write songs now, the last 15, 20 years. I just write songs when I'm inspired, and then I have them, and then I don't think about them, and then I forget them, and then... You know what I mean?
Do you record them at least? Do you like write down some tab or something?
I have like a little cassette recorder.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and then, you know, sometimes I just call Klinghoffer and I'll sing it into his voicemail. He's a genius, that kid. I mean, he could remember anything.
Yeah.
And so I'll say, remember like about 6 months ago I left a song on your voicemail, and he'll play it.
Yeah,
he'll
yeah.
Like, yeah, I remember.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. You have your own human your human cassette recorder.
He's one. He helped with this Peace in the Valley song that's on this album.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to get into the battle with addiction a little bit. Around the time, let's see, the timeline that we were kind of talking about here is like mid-80s, and it sounded like, from, you know, watching the documentary Bob and the Monster, it sounded like that's when things were kind of ramping up a bit, right?
Yeah.
You guys were partying all the time, and that's what it was about, going to shows, hanging out with friends.
I don't know what it was like up here, but I know how it happened in L.A. I mean, mm-hmm. there was a threshold of fear that Anthony and Flea and I crossed over in about 84, which is heroin. Like we hadn't done heroin. We were scared of it. We did coke and meth and drank, and those guys smoked pot.
You did meth and you were afraid of heroin.
Yeah, heroin was like, well, there's reasons why to be scared of it.
Oh, sure,
right?
Sure.
It's a soul-sucking drug, and it changes your ability to know yourself.
Right.
So... And so we were scared of it. And then when we crossed over and weren't scared of it anymore, we became very passionate about it.
Right.
And
yeah.
that's that drug. It's insidious. What's so strange now in a 21st century America is everybody's on it. Every football kid in this county's on it. You get hurt, you're on Oxycontin.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing that this drug is thought to be just so, you know, undangerous now. Like it sucks your soul away.
Well, it's just got a different name.
Yeah.
Right. They gave it a medical name.
Yeah. And the awareness of how dangerous that drug is, you know, I know there's a lot of dangers to all the different drugs, but that one, there's a reason why it has the reputation that it does.
Oh, sure.
You know, I worked with this doctor for years, and he used to say, you know, I've never think about how heroin addicts describe the experience. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, think about the words that they use. I love it.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like I'm in my mother's womb. It makes me feel safe. Like these are visceral reactions to an, you know, people say when I've taken a lot of acid, I love taking acid. It's great. You have fun or whatever. It's not that deep an experience. Like, you know, you have fun and you see things differently, but you still go to school and go to work the next day, and it doesn't change your life. From the time you get involved with heroin, it becomes your life.
Yeah.
And it quickly did from 85 till about 96 when I got sober. It was my life. And music was secondary, and girls were secondary, and my kid was secondary, and you know, just that.
Yeah.
And so it's sad now because so many people are being exposed to it. You got to understand the percentage of people that ever took heroin in the 80s was like 3% of the population. Now it's like 20% of the population.
Because of painkillers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens, but there's this big heroin epidemic across the country, and it's because people were primed and don't have that fear of it anymore. They're already addicted to it in a Walgreens form, so they have to cross over somehow. They have to be able to not be sick, you know, and access. It's interesting things happening in L.A. The heroin is almost 50% potent right now, which for years it's traditionally about 30%.
I don't know what do you mean by the potency.
It's 50% pure morphine
okay.
in the average heroin dose that you buy in Los Angeles. And that number was always like 30%. Uh-huh. And the reason why they've upped the intensity of the experience is because the kids' brains are so primed to opioids, they want them to really get a bang for their buck right off the bat.
Right.
You know,
right.
I talked to a lot of drug dealers and you know, they just think of themselves as supply and demand for the most part.
Sure.
And
yeah.
so there was this market that was fresh to them that was caused by the kind of federal government regulating OxyContin because they allowed it to be on the market. I love when you make a mistake, but you don't take responsibility for the mistake. You just kind of make a new law acting like you're doing the right thing, rather than have a real discussion like, who put this shit on the market?
Yeah.
The idea of when they first marketed OxyContin was, oh, people with cancer and end-of-life things. Nobody with cancer and end-of-life is taking OxyContin. They're all on morphine. There's a great drug, been around for 100 years, called morphine.
Yeah.
Anybody dying of cancer has a button in their hospital bed that distributes morphine to them. It was just simply to get another drug, a very highly profitable opioid on the market. And it's killing our kids, like 47,000 this year.
Yeah.
Killing them.
Yeah.
If 47,000 people between the ages of 18 and 34 were dying of E. coli bacteria from Jack in the Box or something, we'd be hearing about it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Sure.
But it's drugs, and they're accidents, and they're kids, and they're selfish, and they're stupid. The way drug addicts are treated in this country is a shame.
Yeah.
And so I try to stand up and say, fuck you. I'm a drug addict. I was a drug addict for years. I made some mistakes. Nothing to be ashamed of. You know?
What was the point at which you wanted to take up this cause? What made you really want to make this push?
There was a guy named Buddy Arnold in L.A. that helped a lot of us get off drugs.
Uh-huh.
And he was an old jazz musician, and he used to say, we got to make it as hip to be so clean as it is to be loaded.
And he was the guy that started MAP?
Yeah, yeah. It's now called Music Cares.
Yeah.
So, and me and Anthony would be sitting there like, that's just never going to happen. Well, you know, but it has to happen. You know, people need to step up and stand up and say, you know, I've been sober 19 years. I don't have any shame about it or need to hide it and be anonymous or whatever.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious that I was on drugs. It's pretty obvious that I'm not now.
I've seen some videos. Yeah.
It's not like a mystery that I need to keep hidden.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I was talking about it with somebody the other day. If you were known as a drug addict, like you can name all the musicians that are drug addicts. If you were a known drug addict and you're still alive in your 40s and 50s, you've probably stopped taking drugs.
Yeah.
It's probably a logical thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's weird how people are so ashamed. I equate the anonymity of the 12-step program with shame about the disease.
I can totally, yes. It took me a long time to open up and talk about my own past addiction.
Yeah.
With OxyContin.
Oh, there you go. I didn't even know that.
Medicinals, yes.
Isn't it insidious?
It's very insidious. And the reason that I was so embarrassed about it, though, is that I felt that my addiction didn't stack up with other people's addictions.
Oh, yeah. Well, around here, there's some legendary
drug addicts. And so I would always kind of keep it, you know, when I'd have a conversation like we're having right now, I wouldn't bring it up.
Wow.
Because it always felt like, well, you know, even though I got to the point where I had like a mild overdose and had to, you know, shove my fist down my throat to make myself vomit.
Yeah.
You know, like that's not real, right? It's not real in the eyes of other addicts or something like that.
That's that.
So there's
that's
shame.
A reverse
you know?
Shame. Yeah.
Right.
It's
right.
better to die with gangrene down the street here? You know what I mean? Is that what a real drug addict is?
Yeah, exactly, right? Well, I mean, part of it is that, you know, and you talk about this in your documentary, and I think you and I kind of share some of the same characteristics in this, is that when I started taking drugs, I took it because I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
You know, from reading stuff like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Exactly.
Or you know, On the Road or something like that.
Oh, you're,
you know?
Right up my alley.
Right,
you're right,
yeah.
In my wheel well.
Yeah, because when I was watching that, I was like, oh, shit, we're going to have a lot to talk about tomorrow. But you know, I never got to the point because I basically was saved before I could get there.
Yeah.
You know?
Or you would have gotten there long-term with the drinking. That's what took care of.
Sure.
That, you know. In the end, Hunter, because I know...
Well, did you ever meet him?
Yeah, a couple of times.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It's not what you would want.
that's an understatement.
But, you know, when he was on, it was pretty fantastic. But
sure.
But there was a lot of times where he wasn't on. And
yeah.
He was just a cranky, angry, you know, whatever. But drinking is this... other long-term problem. I just think that the drug epidemic it's just so quickly can kill you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas alcohol, long haul, will kill you.
Right, right.
And, you know, it's strange about Seattle because when you're strung out on drugs, you know, you're always nervous about what town you're going to and whatever. And Portland was always a town that I could buy heroin at, and Chinatown there.
Yeah.
And I would literally couldn't wait for the show to be over up here so I could drive back down to Portland to get heroin. I didn't even know how to get heroin in Seattle. And I know that changed. I changed as the 90s rolled on.
Right.
Right. Year.
Just stick around for a year.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was funny how now in my day, you couldn't get drugs. Most of the United States, you couldn't get heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And... nowadays, you can get it anywhere, 24 hours a day. I have kids that are my clients at my rehab in LA, and it's on Craigslist.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
it's so readily available.
Kid OD'd in one of my sober livings, and I'm non-judgmental. I'm like, dude, you obviously were going through something, but where did you get it? Everybody reports he didn't even leave the house.
Yeah.
And he goes, guy from Craigslist delivered it.
Yeah.
A guy from Craigslist delivered heroin to my sober living.
My God.
Just like 3 months ago, 4 months ago.
Holy shit.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's, you know. So
How do you keep up? I mean, you know, I imagine that you've seen a lot of people fall.
Yeah.
On this.
Some sad from around here, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you keep up? How do you keep up with that and do that for a living and watch this over and over and over again without losing your shit?
Well, you know, it's very difficult, certain people, right?
Yeah.
Certain people from up here because they had children and, you know, and I talk till you're blue in the face with somebody and it doesn't make any sense to them. That's probably makes you like kind of think, how do I talk to people? So I'm always trying to refine and be able to love someone beyond their kind of guardedness against love.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And, I mean, there's two ghosts in this town, Lane and Kurt, that, you know, nobody really likes to talk about, and it's uncool to talk about it or whatever. But I cared about both of them very deeply, and I think they were both very different.
Mm-hmm.
But same drug.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
And I always felt like, because we're older, the LA musicians, like about, I think like 8 or 9 years older.
Yeah.
And we'd already been through it. And so trying to talk to this next generation, like, dude, I know that it looks so great, but it's really, you just end up in horrible spots. And all the things I've said to Lane more so than Kurt.
Uh-huh.
Like, dude, it doesn't end anywhere, but everybody hating you and you hating yourself. I know it's like you just want to help, but you don't know how to help. You don't know how to put it into words that somebody else will hear. Right?
Yeah.
And And there, obviously, there was, you could see it in his eyes, like, what are you talking about, old man? You know what I mean? And I had that, I'm sure, with the older people that were trying to wise me up.
Right, right.
And or you
nobody
square,
wants to be told what to
or you
do.
Square, whatever.
Yeah.
And talking about love, get the fuck out of here.
Especially when you're one of the most popular musicians in the in the frickin' world. Yeah, totally.
But you just can't see what happens to you with that drug. You know, interesting thing in Seattle, it's the Seattle sheriff that did that thing about the booking pictures. Did you ever see that?
No.
Of the meth epidemic in the 90s here. They would show somebody get arrested, like, and then 2 years later what their booking picture looked like.
Right, right, yeah.
Like, if that literally doesn't, if you don't want to have a conversation about stopping doing drugs, just looking at yourself over a two-year period of time.
Well, seeing what John Frusciante looked like when he was all strung out. Yeah. That videotape that like Johnny Depp took or something like that.
Stuff.
Holy shit. Holy shit.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's doing
that's
all right.
That's insane, man. He looks alive. Good now.
He's alive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, Lane's mom had thought if John talked to Lane, it would have some sort of impact. And John tried. But John really was kind of active for years trying to help musicians.
Yeah.
But, like I said, like, what do you say? What is the right thing to say? You show up at somebody's house, like Elliot Smith's house or something. Like, what do you say?
Right.
Like, dude, we love you. That's usually what I say. Like, dude, we love you, and we heard you're having a hard time. And they're like, the fuck are you doing here? Yeah. I did it with Chris Kirkwood one time. I had heard that his wife OD'd and died, so I just flew out to Phoenix and went
we just had him on the show a little while ago. That was a really heavy conversation.
There you go.
Yeah.
So we go out there, and we find him in the garage, because she had died in the house, and he didn't want to be in the house anymore. He's in the garage. And it almost the whole hour we were talking with him, he couldn't understand that we had come out there because we care about him and want him to come back with us. He was like, are you playing? Are you playing tonight? You know what I mean? Like, no, we came out here to talk to you. He goes, about what? He's smoking crack the whole time. Well, about crack or heroin or
Oh my god, that's gotta be so heavy though, man.
Yeah,
like
was.
I mean, it's gotta take an emotional toll on you.
It was me and Anthony did it, and we were flying back on Southwest, and I remember we just didn't even talk. We're just like, that was a failure.
Yeah.
But you know. Then look at him. He gets
shot in the spine
in a parking lot.
In a parking lot of a bank by a bodyguard.
Fighting for a parking spot. That's how the whole thing started.
Oh my god.
So then mine was
got him clean.
Yeah, mine was somebody gave me a $100 bill because they didn't have a 20. Like, it was the reason why I'm sober is a series of events that are so random and weird you can't. And I always need to consider that when I'm trying to talk to somebody. I don't know what certain people's paths are.
Sure.
Mine was, I used to go to this bar at night and it hit people up for money. Like, it was where most musicians hung out in L.A. called Moguls.
Okay.
And I walk in and Perry Farrell's standing there. And I said, oh, dude, how you doing? A short, small talk or whatever. I said, dude, you got 20 bucks I can borrow? And he's like, oh, I don't, you know. And he pulled out a wad and he only had hundreds. I go, oh, loan me 100. And he gave me 100. And I just went right out to my car, went right downtown and got arrested for like the 19th time. That ended up me being in jail for a month and kicking dope in jail.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not in that lobby of that bar, and I don't get that money. I don't know what happens.
Right.
I do know what happens, you know, because I'd usually, $20 was not going to be enough. I would just hit like three people up for $20.
Right. You'd go from spot to spot to spot. Yeah. Like, I know that. I know that move.
Got to get through the night. Yeah. And I'd start early, go to Small's KO Lounge, Moguls.
Stop off at Canner's, get a roast beef really quick, then continue on. Yeah. So fast forward. You've written this dark and emotional solo record called Survival Songs. What was the inspiration? Was it the life story?
Yeah, well, it was Ian's idea, like, of always taking this raw...
Ian's here on the couch, by the way.
Yeah, right here.
Looking like he's almost fallen asleep.
the rawness of my songs is like stripped down to just singing and a little bit of guitar playing.
Mm-hmm.
And look at them, how they tell the story of my life, and they really do. So half, you know, I think like five of them are from Thelonious Monk, and like three of them from The Bicycle Thief, and then like four other new songs. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in the end, it ends with the only thing I really figured out after all this is just be nice to people, just be kind, just be loving.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been a Buddhist, I went to live in a monastery, I've done everything. And the only thing I can conclude is just be cool to people. And so with my clients, that's why I say that. I say there's not 12 steps in this, in my program,
right?
You know, in the rehab. There's two. Don't use and be cool.
Yeah.
Right? So what does be cool mean? It means be kind, be thoughtful, clean up after yourself. All this, if you need to be explained what be cool is, you're probably an asshole. You know what I mean? Just be cool.
That's a poll quote right there, man. I'm going to pull that one.
Yeah.
That's great.
So,
that's great.
So that and the song Peace in the Valley that ends uh-huh. the record, that's what I've learned. Kindness is, you know, just be kind to people. Even, you know, just simple stuff like cab drivers and the person that delivers your mail. Like, we need a society where people don't just talk about politics of being kind. They actually express it in their daily living.
Sure.
And so, you know, I have kind of this agenda. Like, I think there's going to be a spiritual awakening in America.
I think there's got to be at some point.
It's got to be.
There's got, I mean, it can only go down so far, right?
Yeah. It's got to, something's got to turn things around. I deal with a lot of young people and I ask mm-hmm. them like, so dude, what do you want to do with your life? What do you want to do? They don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, dude, from the time I was in Palm Springs in that bedroom, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be where they make that music.
Right.
I want to be around the people that write those books. I want to live life out there where that is.
Yeah.
And I think there's not that wanderlust about things anymore, and it needs to come back.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think it's so much of a problem of kids not knowing what they want to do, though. I do agree that we still need to have some sort of fascination with, one, travel, because yeah. as soon as you see how another culture handles itself, you know, outside of the U.S.,
yeah.
you know, you learn a lot about life.
Only about 10% of the American public ever leave the United States.
So sad. It's so incredibly sad.
And music, yeah. Well, I didn't know that music was going to be the thing that was going to introduce me to all these different cultures.
Right, right.
But you know, and I don't know what kids should decide, but you got to decide something. You can't just live at your parents' house and take Oxycontin and go to rehab every 4 months.
Although that would be great.
I know what you're talking about. It really would.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Bob Forrest, thank you so much, man. This has been
an absolute
pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for being so open.
Yeah. Where can we find out more about Bob Forrest, where you guys are going to be? When the CD comes out, what, October 9th, right?
Yeah,
this week.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
The 9th.
Excellent.
And I'm gonna go. I told you, I go to record stores all the time. I'm going to Amoeba to buy it on vinyl. It's coming out on vinyl. I have a record. When you're saying I got a record coming out, it's coming out. It's a record. I love that you are
excited about that.
Isn't that badass?
I love it. That's awesome. Is it going to be splattered? You got like colored vinyl?
I hope so.
Or is it just black?
Probably 180 bit, probably costs $30, so I'll probably be the only one to buy it. But
go to Amoeba Records, go get Bob's album. There you go.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks a lot, man. All right, we're back. Let me clear my throat. Man, oh my God. That was such a great, great conversation. Holy, holy smokes, man. There's something about, like, let me totally reel here for a moment. I get down on myself a lot about doing this show and, like, you know, how many people are listening to it and if it's having an effect, if it's, you know, if it's bringing the music that I want to be brought, you know, to the people, you know. And it's conversations like this, like that I had today with Mr. Bob Forrest, that just make this whole thing absolutely worth it. Yeah, I was really happy with this. I was really happy with this. And just going through and editing this and listening back to the conversation, which I didn't, you know, have to edit much out of this because it was all amazing. And Bob, you know, a lot of that falls on Bob's shoulders because he's such a good talker. And he's so good at telling his story. So, yeah, man. Wow. Bob Forrest. What a great dude. Please, please, please go to bobforrestmusic.com. Check out his podcast called This Is Water with Bob Forrest. Check out his book called Running with Monsters, which is out now. Check out the movie that's about Bob. It's called What About Bob? No, it's not called What About Bob. It's called Bob and the Monster. And then also, God, please, please, please check out this new album that comes out October 9th, his solo record. Survival songs. It's absolutely fantastic. All right? Okay. Do that. We're going to... Yeah. Yes. Do all those. All those things. You can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes. And if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. We're also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, and Cairo Radio apps. And now the Spreaker app at adore.fm for your smart devices, or just visit air-raid.net and subscribe directly to our RSS feed. Keep in touch by liking our Facebook page and see what's coming up on the Air Raid podcast at facebook.com/the Air Raid podcast. Our Twitter handle is @airraidnet. You can follow us there or email me directly at aaron@air-raid.net. There you go, folks. If you've got an idea for the new name of the show, send it in, man. Send it in. Let's do that, right? All right, here's your inspirational quote of the week, as said by a four-year-old.
Have the courage, follow your heart and intuition. They somehow know what you truly want you to become.
I believe that's a Steve Jobs quote. Steve Jobs, yeah, smart guy, smart guy. All right, we're going to go out this week, let's see, the final song on Survival Songs, the album by Bob Forrest. It's called Truth, Chaos, and Beauty, Peace in the Valley. And I hope you guys really enjoy it. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week, everybody.
Chaos and beauty. All religion and philosophy can teach you to hate. But the sun coming up again, another baby gets born, and there's no rhyme or reason. Finish then start, and kindness is everything, and love is all there is. True. When there's peace in my heart, and the road is so winding that you just get lost, my friends, let me tell you, as dumb as it sounds, kindness is everything. Love is all there is. Well, kindness is everything, and love is all there is.